Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to our latest podcast of New Books Network in Anthropology. I'm Yadong Li, a host of New Books Network, and also a PhD student in Anthropology at Tulane University. Philanthropy, divine worship, and time. These are three quite different but equally very important topics in social science and humanities. In his most recent book, Dr. Konstantinos Retikos examines how the economic has been reconstituted to better serve goals of redistributive justice in Java, Indonesia. This is also a book bridging anthropology with continental post-structuralist philosophy to arrive at a general theory of everyday economic practice as a temporal phenomena. So in short, it is a book examining some classic anthropological issues through the lens of time. This fantastic new book, A Synthesis of Time, Zakat, Islamic Microfinance, and the Question of the Future in 21st Century Indonesia, is published in 2020 by Pilgrim Macmillan. And thank you for coming today, Constance.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about the book.
Well, it's just delightful for me to see you today and chat with you about this book. So it is not a, you know, most new book, but, you know, it's your most recent book. So Constance is reader in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at SOAS, University of London. So I'm a SOAS alumni. When I was a student at SOAS, University of London, Constance was a director of the MRS program, and we had a lot of discussion about post-structuralist philosophy, about temporality, and I received so many helpful instruction from Constance. I also got very useful book list, I think, but I do not have enough time to read all of them. I only read a very small portion of them, and I'm very sorry about it. And personally, I found A Synthesis of Time very helpful because my research is quite related to temporality, and I really admire the writing style of this book to combine the philosophical theories into ethnographic observations. So this is why I really hope to introduce Constance's book to wider audiences. So I have talked too much, I think, Constance. So how about we start from your personal background? I know you got your PhD degree from the University of Edinburgh, and in your dissertation, I think you mainly focused on becoming about personhood in East Java. So can you let us know, what brought you to anthropology and to Java, Indonesia?
What brought me to anthropology was good fortune. So it was just a new department in Greece, in Athens, that had opened up the year I was sitting for the national exams for the university entry. And it was a subject that was looked very, very interesting, along with psychology and cultural studies. So the way the exam system runs brought this kind of result, which I embraced. So I did my undergraduate degree in social anthropology and social policy at Pantheon University in Athens, and then for 4 years, and then I did my master's in social anthropology at Kent University. At that point, Kent was, the Department of Anthropology was a key hub for studies of Southeast Asia. So that was the very first time I got acquainted with Indonesia. And I wrote my MA dissertation on Indonesia. And then I went to Edinburgh to continue under the supervision of Janet Karsten with Indonesia. And I did a year and a half of fieldwork in East Java. I wrote the thesis, and then it came out as a book with the title Becoming. An anthropological approach to understanding of the person in Java. And it did feature the lens quite extensively. I thought that I was going to finish with the with the second research, which is the book we are going to talk about. However, it's been continuing for a very, very long time. And the more I'm reading, the more interested I am in his work, but also on Indonesia. Oh, I mean, I finished in 2003 from Edinburgh, the PhD, and then I spent a year as a postdoc at Sussex. And the year after that, 2004, I joined SOS. So this is getting close to the 20th anniversary of my stay at SOS.
Yeah, very fascinating. Although I have known some parts of your academic journey, it's fascinating to know more about it, especially before Edinburgh. So I think it's time to turn to the project of this book. So I think time, economy, and religion are three, you know, pillars of this book. So from a very practical perspective, I want to know, when you started your fieldwork, what was your original focus of research and what brought other focuses into your research?
Well, the beginning of the research on these issues started from a very different point. The point was to investigate the subjectivities of donors who give either zakat or sedekah, and they provide for the poor in Indonesia. So it was much more a study on subjectivity, on ethical self-fashioning. This is how the whole project started. And it was also a study about what the Asia Development Bank at that point called the development of the gift market inverted commas in Indonesia, founding this concept, gift market, potentially interesting. So I wanted to see how the cultivation of a certain self as generous and kind was happening at the same time as a series of institutions were being created in Indonesia, civil society bodies, to create an institutional support for the cultivation of these selves. This is how it started, but it became something quite different. So the emphasis of subjectivity is no longer there. And in terms of institutions, there is an emphasis on institutions and actors in the field of zakat and Islamic microfinance, but this time everything has been framed in terms of time and the synthesis of time. And this happened kind of during fieldwork, but also after coming back and processing, thinking about the implications of the ethnography, in terms also of what was happening in the world at that point, which was the post-2008 financial crisis and the way that sovereign debt was being discussed and austerity measures were being undertaken across across Europe and the US. So it's very much a reflection both on ethnography of Indonesia, but also across what was happening in the world at the general kind of level, out of the crisis or the opportunities that were created in financial capitalism out of the 2008 crisis.
Exactly. I can definitely see some back and forth, and also to see some combination of structural transformation, and also your personal interest is also changing. But yeah, it's very fascinating. So about this book, A Synthesis of Time is definitely not an easy read, I would say, because apart from ethnographic descriptions and anthropological series, you have also included many philosophical series in the book. And I think in different chapters, you draw on different post-structuralist philosophies perspective and use them to deepen your analysis of your ethnographic observations. So my question is, who are the expected readers of your book?
Well, this is a very big question that is very difficult to answer. I mean, I have always tried to write as simple and as clear as possible in terms of communicating what I'm thinking about certain things. So for me, though the book might be difficult in terms of making specific demands on the readers, I think any kind of person with an open mind should be able to follow and engage with a book without any prior knowledge of either anthropology or philosophy or Islamic studies. I mean, at least this is how I'm imagining my audience when I'm sitting down to write something. Why? It's not easy, but at the same time, I think it doesn't take a lot of things for granted in terms of the background, the baggage the readers should bring to the discussion. On the other hand, of course, it is a kind of an academic, kind of scholarly work that is addressed to anthropologists, economists, people who are working on development, people who are working on Islamic studies, on Islam, Indonesia, and beyond. Now, if philosophers also find it interesting, that would make me especially happy. And I think they should. I mean, since, you know, the people, the philosophers it's engaging with, Derrida and Deleuze were reading quite a lot of anthropology, and they couldn't do otherwise because the structure of Levi-Strauss was very, very important at the time. They were starting up their career as philosophers. So because they are reading anthropology so carefully and so closely, I think it's also an obligation of anthropologists to be reading the work of these philosophers, because their work is already informed by anthropology. And I think this is quite obvious in D.E.D. books. It's quite obvious in Derrida's work as well. And of course, Foucault is kind of an ethnographer of the past, and he provides ethnographic descriptions of the past of the finest detail. So I think there is a lot of common ground with the way Foucault kind of conducts his genealogical studies.
And that's the, I think personally, your book, I'm not a philosopher, and I'm not, you know, now I'm not a professional anthropologist, but basically I think the ethnographic material and a vignette in this book, you know, exactly helped me to understand some philosophical concepts. So I think it is very helpful. And about the structure of this book, so the chapters in this book are not framed chronologically, but deal with separate topics and dialogue with one or more series in each chapter. So what was your purpose in framing the book in this way?
So the way the framing has come about is it's the result of identifying the key actors in the field of zakat management, Islamic microfinance. There are three specific actors. It's the state, administration state, the way laws have been formulated and enacted. And this often happens in conversation with Islamic jurisprudence. So Islamic jurists, Islamic scholars, and the way they have framed specific concerns that have found their way or not to national laws is one body of factors. Another body of factors is civil society organizations, bodies which have been created for the purpose of managing Islamic donations and zakat, the zakat management bodies. And of course, their donors, their staff, professional and volunteers, and recipients as they come together through specific programs. And then there is a third category of actors, we can talk more about them, who I'm calling solicitors. These are anonymous actors who act under cover to accomplish specific things. So this is a third category. And to me, this category is quite important because it defines objectification. So it's something that I have tried to achieve both in the first book with under the concept of becoming, to find a way to conduct ethnographic description, which avoids falling into the trap of objectification. And this time, this desire has been very much pursued through this concept of solicitors and soliciting.
Great. I can see it's a very thoughtful design because it continues your previous focus in your previous project, but it also seeks to present a comprehensive picture of Islamic economy, because you, in different chapters, you focus on different participants. I think it's very helpful for the ethnographic writers to learn about. So about the keyword of this book, this is an ethnography, I think, first of all, about Islamic economy. And a keyword in Islamic economy is zakat. So based on my reading, I think zakat is a kind of wealth transfer, but with very strong Islamic roots. So as our audiences may not know much about Islamic tradition and about contemporary Indonesia, could you please give us some information about this term and tell us how zakat plays a very important role in Islamic economy in today's Indonesia?
Well, the first thing is to know that most studies that have to do with the creation of an Islamic economy have to do with the banking sector and the ban on the charging of interest. Zakat is a different pillar to this. I think it's much more important because it's Zakat is one of the five pillars of the faith, third in order of priority. So it has to do with worship. It's a ritual which involves the transfer of wealth for the love of God. It constitutes an act of worship, as I said. And the question now, in terms of its articulation with the Islamic economy, is the ways in which contemporary institutions and contemporary bodies, and including scholarship, have problematized the way this transfer of wealth needs to be conducted in order for an Islamic economy to be founded on Islamic ideas about justice. So for a lot of Islamic scholars and Islamic economies, zakat is understood as an instrument of justice, and an instrument that, when put into practice, it would create, it will alleviate poverty and it will create prosperity. So these concerns about justice, about alleviation of poverty and prosperity are key in the way it has been put into practice in a modern context. And in this modern context, we're talking about not the zakat fitra, which is the usual zakat most people associate with Islam, which is something that is a levy on all believers and it's paid at the end of Ramadan, but zakat mal, which is zakat on property. And this category of zakat mal has come to be revised quite heavily in recent decades, with the addition of new forms of wealth, new forms of property, which must be subject to zakat. So while classic categories will fall into agriculture, the produce of agriculture and trade, these days, lots of Islamic jurists from the 60s and the 70s onwards have included lots of new categories of wealth like wages or stocks into the categories that require to be subject to zakat. So the idea behind making zakat a formal component of an Islamic economy is to amass a very substantial body of wealth that is then going to be, most of it is going to be dedicated to the alleviation of poverty. but in a way, and this is quite important, that is not, at least in Indonesia, the emphasis is not just on giving, you know, funds to alleviate or provide immediate relief, but to provide funds in a way that empowers the poor so that they can set up businesses or they can pursue schooling that is going to lift them out of poverty in the long term. And this is where the whole thing becomes quite important, because there is a certain alignment between the zakat as an instrument and the way that empowerment is being understood in a global financial and liberal kind of way.
Well, thank you, Costas, for this very detailed elaboration. So, Costas, I know your research interests and theoretical orientation are greatly influenced by the French philosopher Deleuze, so especially his creative understanding of time. And as I mentioned before, time is a key theme and analytical lens of this book. So what inspires you to analyze what you observed in your fieldwork from the perspective of time? And could you please tell us what is the synthesis of time?
So I think the inspiration came a couple of years after fieldwork. The question for me, what I was focusing on following the institutions I was collaborating with, was Islamic microfinance. So in Islamic microfinance, as in other forms of microfinance, you have a creation of debt for the purposes of wealth creation. And I was trying to understand why debt was such an important instrument. And this kind of coincided with the effects of the 2008 financial crisis, where it had become quite obvious that debt was a very important instrument for regulating our everyday lives here and across the world. So I was trying to understand what was significant about debt. And the debt was important also within a salvific horizon, a religious horizon, because sins are debits and good works count as credits, and this is going to be balanced out to be judged on Judgment Day. So at some point, I started understanding that the whole question about debt has to do with the importance of time. And it's about how do you secure a specific future? How do you make a specific future arrive? How do you block specific potentials from realizing themselves in the future? And how do you preserve a specific form of the present in the future? Or how do you make the transition from you secure the present returning in the future? So I remember I was taking bus number 30 going back home when I realized that, and the news came to mind immediately, because I knew his work on difference of repetition, and then I started trying to find out how I can bring the loose and difference of repetition in a series of time together with this idea about death and the future. Yes, and the result is basically the book. But also the good thing with the book is that it brings also Derrida and Foucault into the conversation, and this is important because it contextualizes the loose at the same time, because this Deleuze, Foucault, and Derrida, in my mind, they go together. They are very different as philosophers, but I think they respond to the same challenge that Friedrich Nietzsche set out in the 19th century, and also they respond to the end of the Enlightenment. So it was good for me to be able to contextualize a Deleuze in this way, and kind of do, kind of, if I can say, an ethnographic study of philosophy of the 60s and the 70s in this way. So I approached these three philosophers as an ethnographer, and I did the same thing with them as I did with the material on Indonesia, trying to create connections between the three of them and trying to create connections with the material from Indonesia. So that's the way I approach philosophy as an ethnographer of the life of philosophy. Philosophy has a social life. Philosophy occurs in a specific time and place, and we need to understand why certain thoughts are being thought at specific temporal and spatial conjunctures. And that's how the kind of the book and kind of came about.
Yeah, I definitely agree with what you said. And as we have already talked about Deleuze, his interpretation of time, and also the three types of synthesized time. So let's, you know, talk more about it. So in your book, the first one of synthesis of time is the synthesis of habit. The second is the synthesis of memory. And the third is the synthesis of eternal return. So basically, I'd like to hear more about this typology. So basically, it's based on Deleuze's understanding, but actually you applied this understanding to more specific ethnographic materials. And could you please tell us how do you use this framework in your analysis of Indonesian and Islamic microfinance?
Yeah, the book is actually a modification of the three theses of time of Deleuze. I mean, as you said, Deleuze is talking about Hume and the habit as the first synthesis of time that is placing an emphasis on the present. And then there is Bergson and the synthesis of time that is performed by memory. And then there is the synthesis of time of the future. This comes from the internal return of Friedrich Nietzsche. I have modified this to fit the actors are identified as important. So the first synthesis of time is the synthesis performed by the state, and is the synthesis of time conducted with the past as being dominant. Now that discussion is taking a lot of inspiration from Derrida and his force of law, the way he reflects on Benjamin's article about violence, in the way he tries to decouple justice from the law. So the first synthesis of time, according to the book, is performed by the state through law and the way the law and the state tie justice to their purposes. And the second synthesis of time has to do with the present, and it's very much performed by the civil society institutions, the Zakat management bodies, and how they try to bring about a future which preserves the present but gives it an improvement. So it's about improvement, about incremental improvement, and little bits of progress being performed by the way these Zakat management bodies manage to distribute Zakat and other donations to the poor, with an emphasis on them becoming entrepreneurs that will be able to lift themselves out of poverty bit by bit along a kind of longer or long-term kind of trajectory. And the third synthesis of time is the one that is performed by solicitors, the ones who do not accept gifts but produce and take wealth that belongs to them in undercover and through anonymity. And this is the most appropriate, I find, synthesis of time that brings about a future as radically different both from the present and the past. And it's different from the present but the, and the past because it affirms, it's a way of life, it's a way of conducting wealth transfers, which has neither to do with a gift nor with commodity. And instead, it affirms the otherness of the solicitors, the otherness of the divan, and the otherness of the future, because it is very much reliant on a taking and an elimination of our identitarian politics. So by the solicitors conducting themselves undercover, and by remaining anonymous, they set up a certain block to an emphasis on identity and an emphasis on gift and an emphasis on commodity, an emphasis on exchange. They deny a wealth transfer that involves reciprocity. So they take symmetry out of the question and they make everything asymmetrical in order to create, to put in place such an interval that will block both the past and the violence of the state and the incremental improvements of civil society institutions from happening again in the future. So that's the modification. At the same time, this is what the book has to offer to philosophers or those who are specializing on Deleuze. It's what anthropology returns, even though it has not been solicited, such a return to this body of knowledge. And I was very, very lucky to have the basic idea kind of confirmed by specialists of Deleuze when the article came out from the Journal of Deleuze Studies in 2015. It was quite an important moment for me to have this dialogue with them that allowed me to take things a bit further with the book. I needed to know that I'm studying on solid ground, because I've not been trained in philosophy. I'm just interested in this.
Yeah, but I think this is the most amazing part, because when you talk about the synthesis of eternal return, you introduce the concept of solicitor. And here, I think, is the most theoretically ambitious attempt in this book, because you not only connect the philosophical theories to ethnographic observation, but also connect three philosophers from Nietzsche to Deleuze and also Derrida. And here I think it's a good time to talk about Derrida. So basically, Derrida's insights on time are highly based on his review of gift, which is definitely a classic topic in anthropology, and his critique on the metaphysics of presence. So basically, I think Derrida's deconstructive approach is very useful for us to find the cracks in solid and taken for granted relationship and concepts. So how do you follow Derrida's deconstructive approach in your book, in your analysis? Could you please introduce your practice in your book?
So the thing is that the basic text of Derrida that questions the anthropology of the gift, Marcel Mauss, but also Lévi-Strauss, is Given Time. But in order, it took me some time to be able to come to terms with it. And I think, came to terms with it after I read His Voice and Phenomenon. So a book that came out two decades before, I think 68, and came out together with Grammatology. And in the Voice and Phenomenon, he's talking about Edmund Husserl and the way that Edmund Husserl both kind of confirmed the metaphysics of presence, so through his emphasis on the internal speech act, internal monologue, and his emphasis on the immediacy of meaning, but also by Derrida showing a certain departure from this metaphysics of presence in the thought of Edmund Husserl, when Husserl came to conceptualize the passing of time as contingent on the time splitting itself between a past that is elapsing and a future that is yet to arrive. So this splitting of time kind of made presence, the metaphysics of presence, again, kind of problematic. So I had to read what I read on Given Time, the Critique of the Gift, in Land of Voice and Phenomenon. And Derrida is also conducting a critique of Mauss and anthropology and Levi-Strauss and the whole idea of reciprocity along a temporal kind of register. Again, she says that as long as the gift is kind of subjected to reciprocity, we will never know what a gift is. The gift as a category remains unthinkable because it is subject to symmetry. It is subject to a return. And for him, he says basically that in order to make the gift thinkable again, we need to make it contingent on a forgetting of the passing of the gift and a forgetting of this forgetting. So you need a double forgetting in order to make gift thinkable. And again, this it makes time a foundation to the conduct and the understanding of the gift. Now, the problem with this, I understood it to be that the way Derrida was reading Baudelaire's counterfeit story, the counterfeit money stone, and later on the way she was reading the sacrifice of Isaac by Abraham, everything was hinging on the donor. There is a certain alignment between Derrida and the anthropology of the gift with the privileging of the donor's perspective. We are constantly called to attend to the donor rather than the recipient. The recipient is always secondary to it. So then I went back to Mauss, and then I went back to Malinowski, and I found certain passages in the studies which have not received appropriate attention. These passages, the gift is made contingent on the performance of specific spells. And the spells produce the gift because they are forcing specific people to part with their wealth and give it to the recipient. So the recipient, in a certain way, is producing the gift by casting these spells against the donor. So it for the recipient is forcing the donor to give a gift, which is no longer a gift because it's not given freely. Yeah. So this made me think about specific incidences during fieldwork. And these instances, basically, they say that so that wealth disappears, if the person is not a pious Muslim, if the person who is not paying zakat regularly, if the person is not conducting his business in a pious manner, his or her or their wealth is often subject to money seeking. So I wanted to understand this disappearance, and the disappearance is usually attributed to an actor acting in stealth to remove wealth forcibly as an act which is positive in the eyes of God, because such a person has proven himself not to be biased and thus not to be entrusted with wealth from much longer. So this transfers of wealth were conducted neither in the shape of a gift nor in the shape of commodity. And this is where this idea of solicitors has come about, in terms of naming the actors that perform this transfer of wealth, which conforms neither to gift nor to commodity, an act which is forcefully implemented, but it's also positive in the eyes of God. So out of this emerged the idea of positing a critique of both the anthropology of the gist and the anthropology of commodity exchange, because they both privilege exchange, the reciprocity symmetry, but not in a way that revolves around forgetting, but in a way that makes the future the most important dimension of this act, because they do not make the same return. They do not make either the gift or the commodity return, but something else, which remains an open question. Yeah. So they are acts of wealth transfer that go against exchange. They go against the contract. Nobody has any contract with anybody else. Nobody makes a promise of a return. It's a one act, complete in and of itself, that very moment. Mm-hmm. And the force and the stealth and the anonymity with which it is conducted, I think, is one way of thinking about how a future otherwise can come about. Because both gift and commodity, they generate a repetition of the same. A gift calls for a counter gift again and again and again. So it reproduces itself. A commodity also reproduces itself because you change commodities in the marketplace. There is no way out of it. So these forceful acts of wealth transfer by anonymous actors is an opportunity to open the possibility of thinking of an alternative economy, which is not based on the chains. And this is what we know since the basically 16th or 17th century with Rousseau and Thomas Hobbes. Maybe all these ideas have not been put in the book. The book has a companion, and the companion is the introduction to a special section of How, which is dedicated to Adam Smith. And that special section lays out this other story that did not become part of the book for reasons of space, basically, and also legibility. A book can take a certain burden, can carry a certain burden, cannot carry everything. So I had to split things to a certain extent to make the book manageable. But that's the long story cut short. It's the occasion for thinking about conducting the economy in a manner that is neither succumbs to the gift nor to commodity. And the problem has always been that, you know, anthropology has valorized the gift as a critique of commodity, when actually this is a pair. They always go together. And the most successful businessmen were looking to convert their wealth into foundations, and that alleviate poverty. So these two things, I think, they have been misplaced in opposition. They need to think of as a pair, that always goes together, and that we need to find a way to disrupt this pair that dominates our lives.
Marvelous, because I just realized there is a double solicitation here. The first one is you analyze your interlocutor's practice as a kind of soliciting. The second is your analysis itself is a solicitation of previous anthropological understanding of gift commodity relationship. I think, yeah, it's so I think this interview is very meaningful, it's very useful for me because it also brings me many insights about your book to, you know, every time I read this book, I can get some new thoughts. So thank you for it.
It's very kind of you to say that.
Exactly, because I have never, you know, I understand there what you said about your interlocutors act practice at solicitation, but I have never thought about your writing itself is a kind of soliciting of previous anthropological literature. So yeah, it's very insightful. And so basically this book is also part of the deconstructive project, you know, following Derrida.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, if there is a critique of Derrida in its specifics, there is an affirmation of Derrida's project in its generality. So I don't mean it as fighting fault with Derrida. It's quite the opposite.
Yeah, exactly. So as we have talked much about Deleuze and Derrida, let's talk about the anthropologist's relationship with philosophy. So in the last chapter, you mentioned today's anthropology has not fully appreciated and explored time as the irreducible sign of an overflowing excess. So can you tell us why this is important and what kind of transformation or changes it will bring to anthropology if we give further attention on time?
I think the idea is quite simple, that I think anthropology has thought about difference in a very spatial manner. So because it has associated difference with culture, a culture with territory, it has come to reduce difference to a spatial phenomenon. And at the same time, it has allowed history to appropriate time. But history itself has talked about time as in terms of a sequence of events, in terms of a sequence of big men performing great deeds for better or worse. And of course, this changes with Foucault and his genealogy, and that's something I think we should all learn from. But at the same time, what I would like to see is anthropology moving to a conceptualization of difference, not in spatial, but in temporal terms. And this has become very clear to me. I've been going to Indonesia for fieldwork since the late 1990s. Indonesia is not the same place it was in now. It's not the same place it was in 1998. There are vast, vast differences. But I have also come to realize that in order to encounter difference, I do not need to travel to Indonesia. That my encounter with alterity cannot and should not be contingent on this spatial journey. So, this is where the next project comes into things, basically by asking anthropology to reconfigure its foundation from a spatial understanding of reference to a temporal one. We also need to reconfigure how to conceptualize alterity in a non-spatial manner. And this is exactly what the next project is trying to address and to a certain way achieve.
Great. It's very happy to know that your next project is still in the continuation of your exploration of time. So throughout the book, your analysis draws inspiration from three philosophies, from Derrida, from Deleuze, and from Foucault. So based on your experience of writing this book, how could anthropology and philosophy engage in effective dialogue in the future? And in particular, what is the role of ethnography in this interdisciplinary dialogue or collaboration?
The work of these three philosophers is already are informed by anthropology. And they knew the work of Marcel Mauss, they knew the work of Lévi-Strauss, Pierre Clastres, the work of Edmund Leeds. This is quite obvious. The important for me is that to be able, as an anthropologist, I need to be able to fill in a certain control of the words, of the concepts I'm using. And in order to be able to feel in control that I know what I'm talking about, I have found out that I need to engage with philosophy, because philosophers are experts in creating, elaborating, advancing concepts which have a specific history, and they take them in specific directions. So in order to be able, I'm not subscribe to the position that ethnography is a neutral description of what we witness, because such a naive view bypasses the constitutive role of language. And because we use language to communicate with one another, we need to be able to know as much as fully as possible what is exactly meant by the words we are using to conduct ethnographic description. So it's all in the aid of ethnography that I'm reading and deploying philosophy. The objective is to conduct ethnographic description with as little as possible assumptions and presuppositions. And you can arrive at this one to know fully well what is the baggage a specific word carries with every time you use it. So I do not see how it's possible not to engage with philosophy as ethnographers. In order to be able, and that's before we reach the point of trying to conduct a cultural critique. I'm just putting things only at the level of good ethnographic description, which is description with as little as possible in terms of assumptions and presuppositions. Now, if we want to go into the second objective, that of conducting cultural critique, then we need the aid of philosophy as another venture, which also conducts its own cultural critique, not from the point of view of ethnography, but from a different disciplinary practice that has to do with reading and rereading, doing and undoing philosophical kind of texts. So again, I cannot see how you can do anthropology, you can do without philosophy, for the second objective as well. You need the assistance of philosophy in order to further your objective of conducting cultural critique. You need as many allies as possible to help you along the way. But the same thing, I have also found Islamic jurisprudence to be an extremely fertile field of engagement. I have learned many things. I have taken lots of inspiration from the way Islamic scholars understand zakat at different contexts for different reasons, and it has helped me a lot to position the ethnography of what I saw happening on an everyday level. So this Islamic jurisprudential reasoning, I have found it extremely, extremely interesting. These days, I find film criticism or film studies equally important. So I will say that the disciplinary, we need to undiscipline ourselves by learning to do transdisciplinary work. I'm not in favor of discipline, either in the guise of disciplinary practices or in the guise of scholarly practices, which are also conducted in a disciplinary way. So we need to undiscipline ourselves and undiscipline anthropology as much as possible for the same reasons.
Exactly. And also, I think the boundaries within philosophy, I'm very looking forward to seeing a future ethnography could combine non-Western background philosophy and ethnographic observation. But, you know, I cannot imagine it now, but maybe in the future, some ethnographers will do it. And definitely your book is definitely a very inspiring attempt to combine the continental philosophy and anthropological theories. So,
I also found the work of Meg Strather and Villers de Castro in this is extremely philosophical. So I'm not quite sure where will I draw the lines. They could equally be on the side of philosophy because they are able to draw specific metaphysical conclusions on the basis of ethnography. And of course, this is perfectly legitimate. Why can you draw metaphysical conclusions on the basis of reading Plato?
Mm-hmm.
Not on the basis of reading Islamic jurisprudence in Indonesia today. And I don't think it makes any difference.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's especially significant because you quoted lots of Indonesians, writers and philosophers and economists work in your book. And we can see in the future there will be more and more overlap between this, you know, theories and philosophical thoughts and also in the anthropological work. So as we are approaching the end of today's podcast, the final question is, what projects are you working on now and what's next? I know you are doing very exciting research on films, which is also a major topic in Deleuze, his writing. So please share with us your current and future projects.
Yeah, as I said, the project I'm currently engaged in has to do with cinema. I've been going to cinema for many years, lots of movies as a friend of cinema. But after COVID, this has taken a much more serious dimension. And I'm interested in the work of a specific Greek director, renowned amongst those who know about cinema, Theo Angelopoulos. And I'm very interested in him because he has a very strong ethnographic perspective in terms of the way he films Greece. He conveys this very strong ethnographic perspective by saying that his films are about the the other Greeks. And I'm very interested in how he goes about accomplishing this othering. He's very important to me because I grew up with his films. I saw the film I like best the very first semester. I was a student in the anthropology department in Athens. So my starting of anthropology, my starting of getting to know his work kind of took place at the same time. And also because I think along with Alain René, he is a master of temporal manipulation or the synthesis of times when it comes down to his films, especially the films of his first period. So I'm very much interested in pursuing further this anthropology of time through an anthropology of theater, anthropology of his works as well. And of course, Deleuze is still a very important companion, both because of his difference and repetition, but also the way he takes difference and repetition to a new level in his two volumes or in cinema. So at the same time, I don't think I have finished with Indonesia either. I think I still have unfinished things with Indonesia. we'll see how Indonesia will get involved in this process. That's very important Indonesian films I would like to write about as well. Jam Lewat Malam and Opera Jawa. These are also so films I find incredibly very important. So at the moment, the encounters I'm having with authority are conducted across the space between the silver screen and the viewers in many places in London. Another one, and does not require me traveling, expect going to the cinema or just switching on the TV.
Thank you. Definitely. I think cinema is a game of time, and I can see you can have many interesting work on it, and I'm very looking forward to your forthcoming work, and I can't wait to have you back in the future to talk about it. So, Costas, it's always enjoyable to talk with you, and thank you for your time. Thank you for coming to today's podcast.
Thank you, Yadon. It's been a pleasure to be able to see you again and speak to you.
Thank you. The pleasure is all mine. And so today we talk about the new book by Costas Retikus, A Synthesis of Time, The Occult Islamic Microfinance and the Question of the Future in 21st Century Indonesia. If you are interested in temporality, Islamic economy, philanthropy and contemporary Indonesia, or you are interested in how anthropology and post-structuralist philosopher may have combination and contribute to each other, you will not want to miss this book. Thank you for listening to New Books Network in Anthropology, and we will see you next time.